Radio EcoShock.
A group of experienced media analysts just published this study, Greenwashing, Net Zero, and the Oil Sands in Canada, The Case of Pathways Alliance. A co-author is Dr. Melissa Aronczyk. She is professor of journalism and media studies at the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers University. Melissa's research shows how public relations shapes our perception of environmental crises and influences our responses to them. Her most recent co-authored book is A Strategic Nature, Public Relations and the Politics of American Environmentalism. From New Jersey, Melissa Aronczyk, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for inviting me to speak with you.
Well, just to get us started, how do you define greenwashing?
The most straightforward definition I can give you is that greenwashing happens when you promote your product, your organization, or your services as being more green, more environmentally friendly than they really are. A more science-based definition of greenwashing accounts for different ways that an organization engages in deceptive or misleading activities to create false positive perceptions of how an organization is doing in terms of its environmental performance. For example, researchers might look at how an organization leaves out key information in their environmental claim, information that a consumer would need to understand what the organization is saying. Or a researcher might look at how the measurements that an organization is using to claim environmental progress are undercounted.
Who are the companies forming the Pathways Alliance in Canada?
The Pathways Alliance is a coalition of the six largest oil sands companies in Canada. You have Canadian Natural, Cenovus Energy, ConocoPhillips Canada, Imperial Oil, MEG, and Suncor Energy. Together, these companies make up 95% of Canadian oil sands production, so they've pretty much got the market covered. All of those companies are headquartered in Alberta, but of course, these are not just Canadian companies. Imperial Oil is majority owned by Exxon, for example, and ConocoPhillips is an American brand.
Your group found a lot in open records. Where did you look, and does this alliance try to hide things?
Pathways Alliance is basically a publicity machine. They have tons of tar sands information and promotional material out there because their goal is to influence public opinion as well as political decision making. So what we did as researchers was find everything we could that was out there by or about Pathways Alliance, and we chose a two-year period. So we went from June 2021 to June 2023. We wanted to show the range and the scale of their promotional activities. So we started with their websites. There are two Pathways Alliance websites, oilsandspathways.ca and pathwaysalliance.ca. And then we looked at the individual company websites, those six companies I mentioned a minute ago. After that, we searched news databases to find all the news media coverage, mentions of Pathways, podcasts, press releases, and we also collected images that showed their ad placements. I'm sure as Canadians have probably seen, they had ads just covering the Canadian landscape on buses, planes, sports stadiums, that kind of thing. And then finally, we filed open records requests, which are called in Canada ATIPs. ATIPs stand for Access to Information and Privacy. And any Canadian citizen can file an ATIP. Those give Canadian citizens the right to access government records. To your question of does the Pathways Alliance try to hide things, there are two kinds of hiding that I'd say Pathways Alliance engages in. One is to hide from the public what their plans to reach net zero really mean. So Pathways has an elaborate net zero plan, and that includes a 400-kilometer transportation line and a carbon capture and storage sequestration site. But it's not made at all clear in most of their net zero communication that Alliance members actually intend to expand production of fossil fuels. So as a result, we concluded in our article that their net zero plan is really a strategy for allowing increased emissions in the near term. The other way Pathways Alliance hides things is kind of like hiding in plain sight. And this is a classic greenwashing tactic. You know, if you claim that you're on a path to net zero, what are you really saying? Nobody really knows. And that's kind of the point. Pathways uses a lot of vague or unprovable claims. They aggregate numbers from different sources to say that Canadian oil is a better barrel of oil than oil from other countries. But that kind of thing is really hard. It makes it very hard for ordinary consumers to evaluate what they're saying.
And do the oil sands companies tell us what they want? How do they describe the future?
When we were doing the research for our journal article, I remember listening to a podcast interview with the president of Pathways Alliance, Kendall Dilling. And he was talking about how the world is going to continue to need oil for a very long time. And then he said the goal of Pathways Alliance is therefore to deliver what he calls a better barrel of oil, by which he means, you know, the development of a massive technology infrastructure for carbon capture and storage. At the end of that interview, Mr. Dilling also mentioned the advantages of oil for an ongoing non-combustion market. So not just the emissions from burning the oil, but also for products that are made from oil derived from the oil sands. And he concluded by saying there's no sunset for this industry. And that, I think, really sums up the view of Pathways Alliance for the future.
So looking through their publications, the websites and all that, do Pathways Alliance members accept the need for an energy transition?
That's a complicated one. I would say Pathways Alliance recognize the need for an energy transition, at least on the face of it. So again, their net zero communication does claim that an energy transition would take place. But they see the product of their companies as very much part of that energy transition. And I don't think that's the kind of energy transition that a lot of other people are talking about when they say we need an energy transition. For some people, that means really moving away from fossil fuels as a primary source of energy.
Are Alliance members reducing emissions, and how does that square with their profit goals and the new pipelines they're building to deliver more product?
That's a tough question, because we found several indicators of greenwashing in Pathways Alliance's public communication. If you look at their public messaging in the big picture over 2 years, as we did, there are fundamental questions not answered regarding the sector's emissions. We really can't tell whether the emissions are declining or rising, and one of the reasons for that is that the baseline for emissions is very unclear. It's kind of like, you know, a shifting starting point, which, again, you know, makes it really hard for consumers to understand what they mean when they say emissions are declining. The other thing is that information about the cost of the Pathways Alliance plan and the amount of public investment that would be needed to realize that plan isn't available. So, in other words, we don't know how much money is required to create this massive technological infrastructural system, this carbon capture and storage system. It's really not made clear in their net zero communication that Alliance members intend to expand production. So once again, it's hard not to conclude that their net zero plan isn't about a strategy to allow increased emissions in the near term, not a decrease.
So how can net zero promises be used by polluting corporations to delay real action?
Well, it comes back to something, Alex, I mentioned a minute ago. If you're making a promise of future action, which is what almost all net zero promises do, you are basically shifting the goalposts. You're making the answer to the question so far in the future that it's really hard to know whether those corporations are going to reach that goal and what they're going to be doing in the meantime. Any future promise of action, you know, net zero by 2030, by 2050, and so on, these require incredible amounts of investment and time to make those actions even thinkable. And in most cases, the investments that are requested have not been approved. So these are all still at the planning stages. Any current efforts at carbon capture and storage right now are small scale, nowhere near the kind of scale and scope that would be required to actually move the needle on emissions.
Just to add to the confusion, the oil companies play on the United Nations method of describing emissions. The UN created categories from Scope 1 to Scope 3 emissions, and few of us know what that means. Can you describe the three types of emissions the UN talks about?
Yes. Scope refers to a commonly accepted categorization of greenhouse gas emissions, as you say, derived from the United Nations. Scope 1 emissions originate from sources owned or controlled by an organization. Scope 2 emissions are from the energy consumed, and Scope 3 emissions indirectly result from an organization as part of its business model or its supply and value chains. A good trick I found online for remembering how to distinguish those three scopes is burn, buy, beyond. Scope 1 is what you burn, Scope 2 is energy you buy, and Scope 3 is everything beyond that.
And how does the Pathways Alliance allow the oil sands industry to confuse the public about the real scope of their emissions?
The most consistent indicator of greenwashing we found in our research is Pathways' repeated failure to account publicly for all emissions, Scope 1, 2, and 3. The article goes into great detail about how Pathways does this, but to put it simply, we can say that they're using rather non-standard accounting techniques to calculate their emissions. In sum, a clear indication of greenwashing here is that the Scope 3 emissions are not accounted for in the Pathways Net Zero Plan. In fact, the only place in the Pathways Alliance communications that even alluded to Scope 3 was in the legalese, the tiny advisory 5-point font version of its vision deck. It's got a 600-word legalistic cautionary statement about the limits of forward-looking claims. And right there they say something like, net zero references in this announcement apply only to Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. But again, you have to look pretty carefully to find that statement.
So every now and then, a bright scientist or researcher publishes actual measurements of oil sands emissions and pollution. And it's something the government could easily do instead of accepting what I think is the lowball industry reporting. How does the Pathway Alliance react when big-time undercounting is revealed and published in the newspapers?
Yes, I mean, we have seen evidence of that. I remember a year ago, the CDC published a report suggesting that prior research had been undercounting and that the newest research showed that there was considerable undercounting of oil sands emissions in Canada. One of the strategies we used in our research was to look at historical or archived snapshots of websites. Some of your listeners might be familiar with something called the Wayback Machine, and it allows you to look at what a website looked like earlier in time and compare the earlier version to today's version. So what we saw was that when any kind of accusation was leveled at either at Pathways or at one of its companies, the company would then change something on their website to avoid greater scrutiny or accusations based on what was happening. So that's what you see when undercounting is revealed. Pathways will defend its measurements, claim that they're industry standards, and then often make changes on their website to tinker with the numbers.
Some Canadian banks are so heavily invested in the oil sands, there's talk of whether the banks would collapse if the heavy oil industry did shut down. Are banks helping the industry greenwash their climate impacts?
I haven't myself done research in that area, but there are many recent instances in climate-related probes and litigation, including greenwashing claims against banks over the past 3 years. So I do think any research into this phenomenon has to look at the role that banks are playing in funding or allowing for investments to take place in the sector.
Getting to your specialty, Melissa, you study and publish books on the intersection of public relations branding and the environmental crisis. Canada and Canadians have a brand, too. We think people like us, Canadians, are supposed to be so polite and dependable. But now major oil sands companies are kind of swiping that image and wrapping their super pollution in it. How do they do it?
Alex, that's a really good way of putting it. So, Canadians are known for their politeness, their dependability, their friendliness. And you know, whether that's a stereotype or not, I think Canadians are quite proud of that image on the world stage. And what we have seen is the use of Canadian identity, these positive attributes of Canadian identity, to claim that Canadian oil is itself more dependable and friendlier than other sources of oil. Back in 2010, the conservative media personality and lobbyist Ezra Levant wrote a book called Ethical Oil, The Case for Canada's Oil Sands. Now, the primary aim of that book, Ethical Oil, was to insert a kind of moral relativism into oil consumption. He appealed to Canadian values to try to make us feel better about our reliance on carbon-based economies. And so he set up this comparison between Canadian oil and what he called conflict oil in the Middle East. What he was really doing, of course, was, as you say, wrapping Canadian oil sands into the mantle of Canadian national identity. What he was also doing was setting up our future as a Canadian society in terms of choice and self-interest in the face of inevitable and ongoing consumption. It was really troubling. I remember very well when that book came out and the publicity around it. And it seems that Pathways Alliance has just borrowed from that playbook.
The international economy is greased by big public relations firms feeding friendly mass media. Have the oil sands companies and their lobby hired PR experts?
I think it's fair to say that pretty much all oil companies, all companies, period, that want to influence public opinion or political decision-making have some relationship with public relations, whether they do it internally or externally by hiring a firm. It's as standard as having an accounting firm. Companies know that their brand represents an enormous source of value. So having a PR presence to maintain their reputation in the media and the public eye is vital, and never more so than today where we really are a media society.
Pathways Alliance say they are all about solutions to climate change. You say they are a lobby group. Why and who are they trying to influence with their rich resources?
Most fossil fuel coalitions have two main influence targets. One is the public and the other is political decision makers. The public is important to influence because companies want to maintain what's called a social license to operate. And of course, political decision makers are important to influence because the companies want to make sure that any regulations that are passed are favorable to these companies. In the ATIP requests that we made of the federal government, we found scores of lobbying reports that demonstrated that Pathways Alliance representatives were meeting with government officials. So it was very straightforward for us to call them a lobby group because they spend a lot of their time lobbying.
And your paper contains a helpful table of regulations and laws in various countries against deception and fraud. Can these laws and regulations be used against greenwashing? And what countries do you think have the best and worst controls on greenwashing?
The table in our article was indeed meant to show that regulatory measures against deception and fraud around environmental claims are evolving very quickly in a lot of different places. And I think they're becoming more and more effective in raising public awareness about greenwashing and especially about the need for consumer protection. The winner, so to speak, or maybe the region that's out in front when it comes to controls on greenwashing is the European community. Just last month, the European Parliament adopted stricter measures than they already had in place, which were already pretty strict. And these new measures will ban generic environmental claims on products that are made without proof. So like I was saying earlier, these very vague or unprovable statements. They're going to ban claims that a product has a neutral or reduced or positive impact on the environment because the producer is offsetting emissions. So in other words, carbon offsets will not be considered justified in making a claim that a product has a positive impact on the environment. Finally, they're banning sustainability labels that are not based on approved certification schemes or otherwise established by public authorities. Now, in some cases, these regulations are being tied to climate litigation, and that is a really important area to watch. To give you one example, also last month, the District Court of Amsterdam found that the Dutch airline KLM was greenwashing its advertising and deemed it illegal. Now, that's a major legal precedent with very interesting implications across not only the international aviation sector, but all kinds of polluting sectors.
How's the U.S. doing on regulations and laws against greenwashing?
You know, the United States is doing better than it used to. It's true that they are not nearly as advanced when it comes to developing protections against greenwashing. Where I think we are seeing some real movement forward in the United States is in climate litigation. There are north of 20, it might even be closer to 30 by now, active climate litigation cases, and more are coming in various states. And they have proven very effective in forcing companies to heed the admonitions against greenwashing in a way that regulations haven't really worked.
You know, part of me did not want to read this report on tar sands misinformation. It seems so depressing. It's like entering a dangerous mirage, especially for Canadians. How do you feel after this truth-telling? And, Melissa, what are you working on next?
I think it's so important that researchers continue to surface evidence of climate disinformation and greenwashing by organizations. And for me, I actually am very optimistic. 5 years ago, most people were not even familiar with the term greenwashing. And now I think it's safe to say it's not a household word, at least something that a lot of citizens and consumers are aware of and know that it's something that they need to take action on and to hold companies to account for their statements about being environmentally friendly. I think journalists and researchers have really done an impressive job bringing greenwashing to the fore and showing consumers that they don't have to accept false or misleading claims about climate action. In terms of what I'm working on next, I do have a new book project underway. It's on very similar topics as the ones we've been discussing here. It will have to do with greenwashing throughout North America, not only in the U.S., but also in Canada and over in Europe and Mexico as well. I'm also going to continue working with my co-authors, Chris Russell and Patrick McCurdy, on greenwashing in Canada. So you'll have to stay tuned for our next article on that topic.
I hope to get that update. From Rutgers University, we've been speaking with Melissa Aronczyk, professor of journalism and media studies. You can find links to her website and books in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That's published every Wednesday. Melissa, thank you for helping us spot misinformation when we need to know.
It's really a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.